From the Moan Broadcast Center, this is Take 2. May Martinez. Still think you can't take a vacation yet? Well, the LA Tourism Board says yes, you can, and has ideas on where you can. And if you're worried about the kids' school, well, hey, if the hotel pool has Wi-Fi, who says they can't learn by the water? Plus, a movie set in a pandemic where the story requires the characters to wear a mask, wouldn't that make it easier to film right now? Well, it's already been done. It's ahead on Take 2. From 89.3 KPCC and streaming on the KPCC app, this is Take 2. I'm Amy Martinez. Thanks for being with us. Coming up, eat local, shop local, stay local.
We all, both professionally and personally, we all have a part to play in this. It's a win-win for those Angelenos who have the ability to do so.
LA's Tourism Board is asking Angelenos for a little help to jumpstart the economy. That's coming up. But we start with the upcoming election and the mail. Postmaster General Louis DeJoy wrapped up 2 days of testimony yesterday before members of Congress. Before those hearings, he said the Postal Service will suspend any cutbacks to services and operations until after the November election to avoid any appearance of impact on the election. And in comments to the members of the House on Monday, he tried to reassure the public that the Postal Service will place the utmost priority on the mail-in ballots it handles.
To be clear, we will do everything we can to handle and deliver election mail in a manner consistent with the proven processes and procedures that we have relied upon for years.
But the damage may have already been done. Even before this fight over the post office, a poll by Pew Research Center found that nearly half of registered voters said they expect voting to be difficult this November. So to rebuild voters' confidence in mail-in ballots, we turned to a recent study that examined what campaign messages have worked before to persuade some of California's least likely to participate in an election to do so. With us now is the co-author of the study, Francisco Pedraza, professor of public policy and political science at UC Riverside. Welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Sure. Now, you use the term low propensity voters. That just means voters who are eligible but are less likely to go to the polls. For your study, who are these low propensity voters and what reasons do they give for not voting?
We know that folks who come from lower levels of socioeconomic status, these are working class folks who, for a variety of reasons, including when they work, the time that they have available, just leave less room to participate in politics. Another demographic factor is your race and ethnicity, as well as those who speak one non-English language. So they're monolingual. Spanish language, we're talking about also Asian languages. These are the kinds of languages that are often associated with newcomers to the United States. And as a result, just not being familiar with the election systems. And that's why they're often classified as folks who are low propensity.
Francisco, what typically is the top reason why they do not vote?
For a lot of good reasons, right? You've got folks who say, I've got to think about the next thing on my plate. I've got to cook dinner. I've got to pick up kids from school. And voting doesn't pay your bills. So it's easy to say, for right now, voting is just not a top priority.
All right. So then how would options like mail-in voting and ballot drop-offs increase their participation?
Well, it's simple. It makes it more convenient. When you give people multiple options for how to vote, it's something that they can find a way to slip that in. When it's rigid, say, for example, you're only allowed to vote in person and on election day, that really narrows down for a lot of people the possibility that they'd be able to participate. So the mail-in ballot just expands the convenience.
Now, we should note that you conducted your study before this current fight over the post office, so it's tough to judge how these people feel about mail-in voting right now, but there were different strategies to get them on board of the idea in general, so let's talk about a few of those. First one, and this one is really important in a pandemic, mail-in ballots help people avoid crowds. So how can local election officials best get that message across?
What we found is that the best way to deal with voter outreach and especially sending this kind of like crucial information is to address it directly. So putting out any kind of information, for example, that clearly and specifically addresses what kinds of safety measures elections officials will be taking in order to ensure that if you choose to vote in person, that you will be able to do so safely. And having that guidance from leadership early on helps to dispel, I think, very effectively any other kind of misinformation that's sort of out there that may reach voters, especially those low propensity voters who may find it a little bit tougher to navigate through the enormous amount of information and debate and discussion that's taking place around this very topic.
We're talking to Francisco Pedraza, professor of public policy and political science at UC Riverside. Now, another part of this is reassuring these people, these low propensity voters, that their vote will be counted and not lost in transit. So how should officials get that across?
So one easy way to get reassurance that your vote will be counted is to give people a step-by-step explanation of what elections officials are doing to verify voters' ballots, as well as systems that are in place to track a person's ballot. By simply explaining that there is a process in place where elections officials receive your ballot, and then they verify, for example, if you've submitted something, a ballot by mail, and if there's any questions, that they have a procedure in place to follow up with the voter, that is extremely comforting.
Now, one more strategy, because we're talking about a population, you mentioned, with different language skills. And you've also mentioned how simple and clear these messages need to be. So can you give us an example of what you mean by that?
Yeah, it's really crucial that any effort to translate official information from elections official from English language, let's say, into Spanish language, that you take lots of care to make sure that the message and the information is kept as simple and clean as possible, and that you've asked native speakers to vet that translation. So for example, the word safe can have multiple meanings. It could mean safe in the context of COVID, that you won't be exposed to any contagion. It could also mean that it's safe in the sense that it's secure, meaning that there's no shenanigans or fraudulent activity that would affect your ballot being counted. And you want to take care, I think, to make sure that you are translating in a way that doesn't lose the original sentiment, the original sort of meaning that you want to convey.
Now, from what you've seen out of Southern California's election officials so far, how would you rate how they're doing and trying to build up that confidence? All the things we just talked about mail-in voting among all voters.
Everything that we've seen shows that elections officials in Orange County, in Los Angeles, in San Bernardino, in Riverside, they're extremely open to working with community organizations. They're aware of the blind spots that they have, and I think that's crucial. Folks have been very, very open to collaborating and crafting messages and then sharing them with other experts to say, I'd really like your take.
You know, we've been talking about trying to get these less likely voters to participate in mail-in ballots, but with confidence in the Postal Service shaky among many different people. Francisco, which of these strategies do you believe would resonate with all eligible voters in California?
I think the most important thing we need to do is get information out to folks very early on in multiple languages and signal boosts the systems that are available to help people get some reassurance that the post office is doing its best and is in a position to get all of these ballots in over the course of the election cycle. The sooner we can give people an understanding of how the system works, the ballot tracking system, the ballot verification, the sooner that I think that people will feel a resurgence in their confidence.
Francisco Pedraza, professor of public policy and political science at UC Riverside. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
All right, turning now to the 2020 census. Earlier this month, the Trump administration suddenly announced it would cut the census short. Instead of ending on October 1st, as the Census Bureau had planned for months, the counting phase is now set to end September 30th. KPCC's Carolyn Champlin has more on what's become the race against the clock to get Angelenos counted.
It's 90-something degrees out one recent afternoon, and advocates for the census are walking door-to-door in Boyle Heights, trying to raise participation for this year's count.
It's the census. Have you heard of the census?
These community outreach workers are not part of the Census Bureau. They work independently. But when the federal deadline was moved up, that put pressure on them too.
So we had to speed up, right? Because, you know, we need to ensure that everybody participates.
That's Roberto Bustillo, program director for Proyecto Pastoral, a local nonprofit for civic engagement and education that's among the local groups doing census outreach. I join him as he hangs flyers with census information on people's doorknobs and on fences, letting them know that they may soon get a knock on the door from a census worker.
Right now, what we're going to do is we're going to hit one of the census tracks that has a very low response.
We start out at the intersection of Cesar Chavez and Soto, then work our way east towards the streets surrounding Evergreen Cemetery.
This area is super dense. Super dense, most of them immigrants, Spanish speaking.
Bustillo tells me the census tract we're in is 97% Latino. Most people are renters and few have broadband access. The neighborhood is historically undercounted. In fact, so far this year, only 40% of households have turned in the questionnaire on their own. Bustillo wants residents to know the census determines how many federal dollars go to services they depend on, like community clinics and school lunches. And now, they only have a few weeks left to claim those resources.
No, tenemos hasta el 30 de septiembre para llenarlo.
Bustillo's co-worker, Kathy Cervantes, is canvassing with us too. She says with the new deadline, it feels like they're racing against the clock.
So yeah, there is pressure. That's why we're here. It's hot and we're still doing this because we feel it a little bit. Like the clock is ticking.
Official Census Bureau enumerators will visit this neighborhood as well. They've been going door to door in LA for 2 weeks now. But advocates like Bustillo and his co-worker Cervantes feel like they can build trust in the census with residents before a federal employee comes knocking.
We look like we're from here, right? So we look like you can trust us.
And actually, Cervantes is from here.
Today was very meaningful for me because I was able to give out information on the same street that I grew up on, in the same apartment building that I grew up on.
After a long afternoon with the canvassers, I called up Aviana Uribe with the LA County CEO's office. She coordinates with the state to help community partners like Proyecto Pastoral do census outreach. She knows that reaching people in person is one of the best ways to raise participation in communities like Boyle Heights. Uribe says the recent news that the census would wrap up early was upsetting.
We're cutting the opportunity to reach those families. So for us, I think it was pretty devastating. At least I could speak for myself, and I think I could say the same for a lot of our partners.
At this point in the city of LA, only 55% of households have completed the census, with just over a month to go. It's a timeline that researchers and even census employees have called impossible. With that in mind, is an undercount inevitable at this point?
I wouldn't be surprised if we had an undercount. I mean, just considering the political environment that we're operating, as well as COVID. But, you know, I'm being cautiously optimistic.
LA County is among the hardest to count regions in the U.S. I asked the Census Bureau, what's the strategy for making sure Angelenos are represented? Like, are any particular neighborhoods being prioritized? Census officials responded in an email that did not have those details. Instead, they offered a reminder that according to the Constitution, all census tracts must be counted. I'm Caroline Champlin.
All right, a reminder, it is night two of the Republican National Convention, and tonight has a theme. It's called Land of Opportunity. Some of the speakers will be Kentucky Senator Rand Paul, the president's youngest daughter, Tiffany Trump, his son, Eric. Also, Secretary of State Mike Pompeo will be there, and First Lady Melania Trump will speak as well. NPR's special coverage of the Republican National Convention starts at 6 o'clock right here on 89.3 KPCC. All right, now, California just got a few billion bucks more to help folks dealing with unemployment, and that adds up to an extra $300 a week. However, it has a quick end date and has a limited scope for eligibility. Find out who can and can't get the help when Take Two continues in about 60 seconds. Stay with us.
My mother told me away. Said, son, when I'm gone, don't forget to pray 'cause there'll be hard times. Hard times, oh yeah, yeah. Who knows better than I? Well, I soon found out just what she meant when I had to pawn my clothes just to pay my rent. Talking about hard.
Back now with more Take 2 on 89.3 KPCC and KPCC.org. I'm E. Martinez. Now, in case you missed it, over the weekend, California got approved for a $4.5 billion in unemployment benefits through something called the Federal Lost Wages Assistance Program. That will pay out an extra $300 a week to those who are eligible. For more on how it works and when it might kick in, we have KPCC's business reporter, David Wagner. David, welcome back.
Great to be here.
All right, so who will benefit from this and for how long?
So this is designed to be a short-term replacement for the $600 per week program that expired last month. Remember, Congress has so far failed to renew that program, and as a result, millions of Californians have now been going about a month without federal unemployment benefits. And that's sent a lot of people into kind of a financial freefall, because without that money, they're only getting about $340 per week from the state on average. So now we have this new federal program coming in to offer some relief. It was created by an executive order from President Trump, and California just got approved to participate. So most unemployment recipients are going to get that $300 tacked on to their weekly state benefits, but it's not going to last very long. People are guaranteed to get these boosted benefits for at least 3 weeks, but California could run out of money quickly.
Now, you said most Californians on unemployment will get this benefit, but not all. So tell us about the ones that will not be eligible.
That's right. Some people will not get this money because in order to qualify, you have to be at least getting $100 per week in state benefits. A lot of lower income workers are below that threshold, so they're not going to get any additional help. Also, there are freelancers in LA who have mixed sources of income. You know, they can easily get less than $100 per week from the state. I've talked to a lot of LA freelancers in that situation, and they say they feel pretty left behind.
Now, there are about, 3 million Californians on unemployment right now. How significant is this extra help for those who are eligible?
Well, when this plan was first rolled out, you know, Governor Gavin Newsom said $300 per week is better than nothing. And the unemployment recipients I'm hearing from tend to say the same thing. But this is only half of what people were getting before in federal benefits. And that's going to make it tough for people to pay their rent and to stay afloat, especially in a high-cost city like LA.
All right. So do people need to do anything to apply?
So there's not much detail on this yet from the state. Previous federal unemployment benefits were simply tacked on to people's weekly claims. So you might not have to do anything to get this money, but we are going to have to wait and see on that. We also don't know when people can expect to see this money, but we do know the payments will go back to August 1st and people will be paid retroactively.
All right, David, while we have you, though, I want to ask you about some news this week that Long Beach, the city of Long Beach, has joined a coalition of California cities who are looking to launch a universal basic income pilot program. What other cities are part of this and what's the objective?
Yeah, so the mayor of Long Beach, Robert Garcia, has asked the city council there to work with him on designing a pilot program. And there are, again, not many details to go off right now for this program, but in theory, this would give direct ongoing payments to a select group of people in Long Beach. And the goal would be to study how people use this no strings attached money. You know, would they use it to pay their rent? Would they use it to get out of debt, buy healthier food? You'll probably remember that this was an idea heavily pushed by Andrew Yang during the Democratic presidential primaries. Yeah, and you know, Mayor Garcia says this approach is needed now more than ever because the coronavirus pandemic, he says, is making economic inequality so much worse, especially for people of color. This is not a new idea. You know, other cities have also signed up to explore universal basic income, including Compton and the city of LA. The city of Stockton in California has actually already been giving 125 residents $500 per month for over a year now. And that's really gotten other mayors to take a serious look at this.
All right, it's KPCC's David Wagner. David, thanks a lot.
Thanks for having me.
All You may remember a couple of years ago, there were some pretty explosive protests about temporary bridge housing homeless shelters in Koreatown and Venice. Well, now, despite some objections, almost two dozen of those sites have actually opened around the city. But new reporting by KPCC finds that people are not moving into housing in the volume politicians expected when the program launched. Here to tell us more about the results is KPCC's homelessness reporter, Matt Tinoco. Matt, welcome back.
Hi.
We're going to get to the results in just a second, but first, just tell us, what is bridge housing?
Right. So bridge housing is billed as an improvement over sort of regular or conventional homeless shelters. Regular shelters, generally people can't stay during the daytime. It's only a nighttime slot. But bridge housing is considered to be sort of more stable. So people can stay on site 24/7. On-site services are there, healthcare. You have storage for personal property. And then even at the ones in Los Angeles, you could have your pet there. But there's still homeless shelters. You don't have your own room. There's sort of dividers between beds, but it's still a whole big room. Basically, the idea is that it's a place where people can recover from the trauma of being homeless. The bridge is between the street and what politicians say over and over again is permanent housing on the other side. And here in Los Angeles, we have a bridge home. That's the main initiative, building this type of housing driven by Mayor Eric Garcetti's office, basically just because there are so many more people who are unsheltered than there are available shelter beds.
Yeah, I toured the one in downtown where you can keep your pets. That was really early on in the process. Now, Matt, you recently investigated what the results are from some of the first sites. So what'd you find?
Yeah, so I contacted the nonprofit agencies who operate the first four of the Abridge Home sites that opened. These are all sites that have been open for more than a year and had been open for more than a year, even at the onset of the pandemic. What the operators told me is that at those first four shelters, only about one in four people who exit are able to exit to permanent housing. Now, the key point is that when these shelters were opened, and at all the sites that have opened since, the perception politicians have created was that there would be a steady stream of people moving out for permanent housing, but only about one in four are.
Speaking with KPCC's homelessness reporter Matt Tinoco about the slow pace in getting bridge home shelter residents into permanent housing. Now, Matt, why aren't more people making it into housing?
Well, it's the same reason that more people aren't being housed generally, and that is that there's just very little housing that somebody with extremely low income can afford. And then that relative to the scale of need out there, there's just really little public assistance that can bridge the gap between an extremely low income and the high cost of rent. So the result is that a lot of people are on long waiting lists for permanent housing or housing assistance. And that includes not just people in bridge housing, but also people who are on the street or who are in a variety of temporary homeless solutions like hotel shelters and safe parking. But then they just stay there on that wait list for a very long time because there's just a bottleneck in the amount of government assistance that's actually available.
Okay, well, is there more permanent housing on the way? I know voters approved Proposition HHH in 2016 to build more permanent housing.
Yeah, so HHH is that $1.2 billion bond measure voters passed in 2016 to build supportive housing. That's the kind of housing that people in bridge housing would move into, or some people in bridge housing would move into. So far, only two buildings have opened with just over 100 units, but there are many more under construction, and they will open. I just hate to say this like it's good news, but they'll be open probably within the next 2 years. The pandemic has slowed some things down. But still, those who are familiar and sort of know and are doing this every single day, they say that there should be thousands of units coming online within the next 2 years, which will relieve pressure somewhat. But again, it's thousands of units, and there are still well over 60,000 people who are homeless in LA County.
All right, so there may not be much new permanent housing just yet, but I know Los Angeles still managed to build 22 shelters in a couple of years. That's almost 2,000 people who are not living on the streets anymore. So doesn't that qualify as success?
It is a success, but it also depends who you ask. The key tension is just that shelter is not housing. So you're going to see a lot of shelters becoming the sort of final destination for a lot of people when really it should be housing. That's what people are shooting for. Like that our system is trying to get people into permanent housing, but because there's still a bottleneck and nowhere for people to go, people will end up using homeless shelters as a sort of long-term housing solution, which is not what is supposed to be happening, but it is what's happening right now all over Los Angeles in our homeless service system.
That's KPCC's homelessness reporter, Matt Tinoco. Matt, thanks a lot.
Thank you, A.
And if you want to find out more about what Matt has learned about LA's bridge home shelters and the obstacles to transitioning residents into permanent housing, you can go to our website, laist.com. That's laist.com. All right, now to a goodbye. L.A. institution BCD Tofu House lost its founder, Hee Suk Lee, to cancer last month. KPCC's Josie Huang has a remembrance of Lee and how she created a chain restaurant and a cultural phenomenon.
Hee Suk Lee wasn't trying to start a tofu empire when she moved to L.A. in 1989. She came here so her three sons could have an American education. Her husband got to work running restaurants like he did in Korea. Lee started to think that she could too. In an interview with the website Soul of LA, Lee said, quote, "I felt confident that I could do well with this business if I worked with Korean food. The soft tofu dish Lee chose to focus on was far from a showstopper. Sunabu jjigae is a fiery stew, but humble in reputation.
It's down-home food."
Cecilia Hagen Lee is a food writer and chef in LA.
"It's just like, oh, you make it to have something warm and spicy in the winter. This isn't what you serve guests."
But Hee Suk Lee believed she could sell sundubu in the U.S. as the main event, not just by making the perfect dish, but through hard work, something she learned as a child. Her eldest son, Eddie, said she had grown up poor after her father suffered a stroke. Lee's mom supported the family by washing dishes at restaurants and working at a flea market. Lee never forgot the value of money as a business owner.
"She's a very gentle smile, but behind that, she's nerves of steel. She's one of the best negotiators I've ever seen."
Lee opened her first restaurant on Vermont in 1996. The family was living temporarily in Las Vegas at the time, so almost every day for a year, Lee flew to LAX in the morning, drove downtown to buy produce, and then went to the restaurant. Eddie Lee says at the end of the day, his mom would fly back to Vegas so she could spend the night with the family.
"But I mean, literally, we just didn't see her for a year. So, you know, I mean, that's just my mom. She does something, it's like, there is no middle ground. You do it all the way."
And she would take big leaps. She made the BCD location on Wilshire 24/7 against the advice of her family. She knew many Korean immigrants worked late, like those in the garment industry, and would want blazing hot sundubu after work. What she did not predict is how popular it would become with others, like Asian American college kids and the club crowd. Noah Cho is a food columnist for Catapult. He went often to the BCD on Wilshire in the early 2000s.
"It was old school ravers, you know, that wore like baggy Janko jeans with a white tank top with a visor. Like, I had dyed blonde hair and green contacts. It was that look."
Those customers started to bring non-Korean friends. Restaurant people came after work too. Many thought BCD had started in Korea. Daniel Lee Gray runs food tours in Seoul and says Americans would request stops at the BCD there, thinking it was the original. They were such fans.
"After BCD, they would want to try other Korean restaurants. They would want to watch Korean TV shows. It kind of opened their minds to Korea."
BCD's fame grew as Lee started selling tofu stew kits in grocery stores like H Mart. Celebs, Korean and non-Korean, would drop into the restaurants. But the brand's image took a hit in 2013. That's when hundreds of employees sued, alleging wage theft. A 2015 settlement awarded $3 million to the workers. Still, for many people, BCD holds an unwavering special place in their hearts. Writer Catherine Youngmi Kim saw that recently. She had interviewed an elderly Korean couple who had become homeless and were living in a shelter. She asked if she could treat them to lunch. The wife said she'd like to go to the BCD on Western.
"And when we went there, it was clear that she had been a patron there for a long time because the wait staff knew her and the manager knew her. But to her, it was a place where she had a full meal again."
I recounted this to Lee's oldest son, Eddie.
"You know, I think it speaks to, you know, what she was trying to accomplish, providing a place for people to find joy in food, find joy in fellowship."
Lee is a doctor, but after his mom got sick, he cut back his hours so he could help her with BCD, and he became vice president. And after she died, July 18th, he became the interim CEO. Not a path he expected, but he saw how important BCD was to his mom.
"We have a running joke in our family that she actually has four sons, and that her restaurant, BC Tofu House, is actually our youngest brother."
That brother isn't so little anymore, but Eddie has made it his job to look after his mother's baby for her. I'm Josie Huang.
Land of Opportunity. That's the theme for tonight's second night of the Republican National Convention. Some of the speakers tonight, First Lady Melania Trump, Secretary of State Mike Pompeo, also a couple of the president's kids, Tiffany Trump and his son Eric. You've also got Kentucky Senator Rand Paul speaking tonight, night two of the RNC. NPR special coverage begins at 6 o'clock right here on 89.3 KPCC. All right, still think you can't take a vacation yet? I get it. At best, you're concerned. At worst, terrified of leaving your home bubble. Well, the LA Tourism Board says, yes, you can, and has ideas on where you can. And if you're worried about the kids' school, if the hotel pool has Wi-Fi, who says they can't learn by the water? That's coming up when Take Two continues. Stay with us. Back now with more Take 2 on 89.3 KPCC and KPCC.org. I'm E. Martinez. Los Angeles has been a destination for travelers from all over the world for decades. But since March, our once flourishing tourism economy has been decimated. Because of the pandemic, few of the visitors who usually flock to L.A. from other states and abroad have been able to stay, sightsee, or spend money here. So now, Adam Burke, president and CEO of the Los Angeles Tourism and Convention Board, has a message for residents. Angelenos, please help the local economy and become a tourist in your own town. Adam Burke joins us now. Welcome.
Thanks so much for having me. I appreciate it.
Sure. Now, okay, remind us how bad the pandemic has been for LA's tourism economy in terms of people and dollars.
Travel and tourism has become the third largest employment sector in the county. In fact, prior to the pandemic, we actually had over 544,000 people employed in the leisure and hospitality sector. Sadly, you know, travel and tourism was one of the first sectors to be impacted by the pandemic, and it hit us hard to the point where we've actually experienced job losses of one out of every three in travel and tourism countywide. If you look at it, our forecast for 2020, we anticipate that we're going to have about $10 billion less in visitor spending.
Now, Adam, you're promoting the idea of Angelenos doing more staycations in LA. So give us your pitch.
Over the last couple months, we have seen, not surprisingly, that Angelenos have been stuck at home, have started to get out and about. They're starting to explore things in their own backyard again. So what we did is we went to our members and we said, we'd love it if you could put together special offers so that as people are starting to explore their backyard, there are things that make it easier for them and more affordable. But again, because health and safety has to be the first concern, not just for guests, but for our employees as well. In each sector of our industry, we are lending our expertise to specifically develop health and safety protocols that are then approved by LA County Public Health so that we can ensure that we can responsibly reopen our visitor economies.
Tell us about some of these potential getaway packages that you think might appeal to people looking to get out of the house for a little bit and maybe get away from their teenagers.
In terms of the special offers, you're going to see things like discounts on hotel stays and local attractions. And some hotels are actually offering free nights with a minimum length of stay. The other part of it is our culinary community. Dine LA is actually taking a very different approach this go around. And I'm sure your listeners probably know that Dine LA is a semi-annual event. And we have over 300 area restaurants that for the first time include not only their outdoor dining experiences, but we're actually including takeout and delivery as well. So it's a great time to get out and try that local restaurant that you've always wanted to experience. And so many of them are doing outdoor dining. So that's another way that people can help support the economic recovery locally.
Adam, let me ask you this, because one of the reasons, actually the main reason why we are all staying home and stuck inside is to avoid transporting the virus, say, to other areas, other zip codes. So what do you think is a reasonable and responsible distance for Angelenos to travel outside of their usual neighborhoods for these staycations?
It has to be based on each person's individual comfort level. Everyone needs to make sure that we all wear masks in public. And the second thing is that we all just need to follow public health guidance. So I think if people, when they look at where to venture out, take a look at our website, they're going to see what businesses are open. They're going to see what the safety protocols, and that way they can make an individual decision based on their own family circumstances, how far they feel comfortable venturing out.
People are struggling. Some people are really having a tough time even making rent every month. So wondering, yes, who is this really targeted to? If there's so many people out there struggling, who ideally is this message out there for?
It really is targeted to those people who have the financial means to be able to help jumpstart our local economy. You know, we know, number one, that sadly, because so many people have lost work in a number of different industries, that we also understand there are some people who simply can't afford to get away for a staycation right now. Yeah. But I think the biggest thing is we all, both professionally and personally, we all have a part to play in this. It's a win-win for those Angelenos who have the ability to do so. If they can get out and enjoy a staycation, our estimates show that we could get, 10, 20,000 jobs recovered in the county just in the next couple months. So that's the thing that, I think is inspirational about it, is it's not only a great way to get out of the house, but it's a great way to get people back to work.
Adam, will you be promoting the idea to people living in nearby markets such as Vegas or San Diego? And is that responsible to do right now?
I think the mantra for us is absolutely responsible tourism. In fact, you'll see that everything we're going to be advertising has the hashtag travel responsibly, because I think it's incredibly important that we let visitors and locals alike know that when you come here to stay, we expect everyone to abide by the safety protocols that are in place. So following all those protocols, we do have several ad spots that are designed for people in drive markets and in the short haul flight markets. But part of that is, you will see people in masks in the ads. And we're only going to launch those campaigns where we see case counts in those neighboring communities at a point where we feel it's responsible to invite them to come to Los Angeles.
Now, while this kind of staycation tourism probably can't make up for all the losses in the industry, how much does it cover the gap?
We know, for example, that if people were to, for example, take, a 3-night stay in a local hotel and then just eat out at 3 restaurants and visit 3 attractions locally, just that simple act would actually help us recover over 21,000 jobs.
Oh, wow.
And would put almost $1.5 billion back in the pockets of all of our local businesses. So, that's just a for example to contextualize it. But I think to the extent people are able to financially and they feel safely do so, I think in the next 90 to 120 days, we could make a significant impact to help our local businesses get people back to work.
Now, summer is winding down a bit. Many people typically take a vacation in the summer months when they have the time. How realistically do you think Angelenos will be able to find ways to take time off if, for example, kids are back in school or they're out of work themselves and don't have any extra cash to spend?
What we found is with so many schools, even at the collegiate level, going online and having their students working virtually, the beauty of technology is that actually means that people have a lot more freedom now to enjoy these staycations even while their kids are in school. Since we're studying remotely, as long as there's internet access.
That's right.
So I think it's a very strange but promising dynamic, because if you think about it, the only time you can really get away is when everybody can get away. So it tends to be a very busy travel time. This is a very interesting dynamic where I think you're going to see people start to take staycation kind of throughout the rest of the year, because they're still going to be at home with their kids and they're going to have the kind of the luxury of time to figure out when is the best time for them to do it.
Now, eventually people might feel safe about traveling to LA again. Adam, what's your expectation of when that might happen for both domestic travelers as well as international tourists?
I think we'll start to see the long-haul domestic travel come back toward the end of the year. I think what's going to be interesting is seeing market by market when international visitors begin to return. You know, Los Angeles remains one of those shining lights for people around the world because of how diverse our community is, how inclusive it is, how welcoming it is. And as a result, I think we're still going to be over the next decade one of the most welcoming and attractive destinations for people around the world. It's just going to take a while for us to get back there.
That's Adam Burke, President and CEO of the Los Angeles Tourism and Convention Board. Adam, thank you very much.
Thanks so much for having me on. I appreciate it.
All right, just a little reminder, night two of the Republican National Convention is tonight. Rand Paul, Kentucky Senator, is going to speak, and also the First Lady, Melania Trump. NPR special coverage starts today at 6 on 89.3 KPCC. All right, now how about this for an idea for a film? A movie set in a pandemic where the story requires the characters to wear a mask. Wouldn't that make it easier to make this movie these days? Well, it's already been done. Find out the big names that made this movie when Take Two continues in about 60 seconds. Stay with us.
Tonight, I'm gonna have myself a real good time. I feel alive.
Back now with more Take Two on 89.3 KPCC, and most places you get your podcasts. I'm Amy Martinez. Okay, so something happened recently that in normal times was all too common, but in the COVID era has really been unheard of. A film crew actually shot a movie here. Songbird, whose producers include action director Michael Bay, is the first feature film to be shot around L.A. since the pandemic hit. John Horn is the host of the L.A. Studios podcast Hollywood the Sequel, and he's been tracking this story for us. John, thanks for coming back on the show.
Happy to be with you.
Now, okay, so Demi Moore, Bradley Whitford, Craig Robinson, Michael Bay, these are all names associated with this movie, Songbird. So what's Songbird about, and how did it manage to shoot while we had very strict coronavirus protocols in place here in L.A.?
I guess the answer to the second question is very carefully.
Yeah.
What is it about? It's about a pandemic. Why not make a movie about a pandemic during a pandemic? It was not super expensive, not a big studio movie. It was produced independently, which is probably how they were able to get it shot in Los Angeles during the shutdown.
Now, okay, so just to be clear, this is an imagined future for LA 2024 post-COVID-19. I mean, how much do you think the plot of the film played a role in the fact that they were able to hurry up, get it greenlit, and shot this summer?
I think it played a huge role. And there are two things that worked in its favor. So one, it's a movie that you would say, that's pretty topical. You know, I guess There's an argument about whether or not it is escapist fare. But the more important point is this is a movie about a pandemic, so the characters can be wearing masks and being socially distanced. If you were to like make a movie now and you would have people going into like a grocery store, would you shoot them with masks, with plexiglass screens? Like, what would you do? And this is a movie where you said, okay, we're still in a pandemic, so we're going to film it as if we're in a pandemic, because we are in a pandemic. And I think it worked very neatly that way, that they didn't have to pretend that actors were going to behave differently than they would in real life.
That's pretty good. So a component of the story actually helps in the shooting and filming of the film.
Exactly. I mean, it's not like they have to pretend that they're being socially distanced, because they are socially distanced.
Now, okay, so you talked with one of the film's producers, Adam Goodman. Now, what did he tell you about the protocols they had to have on set to ensure safety throughout the production?
Well, he said they were really careful. And Adam is a longtime producer and studio executive, and he's used to making both really big movies and smaller films. And one of the things that I think is really important is on any film set, if you visit a film set, there are people who are in close proximity to each other. The actors, obviously, maybe a makeup person, maybe somebody who's doing hair. the director might be having a very close conversation with the performer. And what they tried to do is kind of separate who needed to be close to whom and make sure that there wasn't too much intermingling. So here's what Adam Goodman said about kind of zones on the set.
It really keeps the minimal amount of required crew at the actual camera. And the people who are in that A zone are tested more frequently than the people who are in the B zone and tested more frequently than the people who are on the C zone. And, you know, by the end of this shoot, I wouldn't say it was ideal conditions, but it was sustainable and it was makeable. And it feels like Hollywood can come back safely and production can pick up again in a reasonable manner.
Got to admit, John, personal preference, I like those A-zones. I like the name A-zone. Something about it, I just like it. Now, what more can you tell us, though, about these zones and how they're supposed to keep people from potentially infecting each other?
Well, it also requires testing, because if you are isolating people in groups and they're able to get tested, then you know that everybody is relatively safe. Now, obviously, there's a problem with how quick test results come back. But the idea is that if you separate people based on how often they're going to come into contact with each other, and you are able to test them, then in theory, you could limit the potential for a possible spread.
Talking to John Horn, he's the host of the LAS Studios podcast, Hollywood, the Sequel. Now, SAG, the Screen Actors Guild, issued a work stoppage order before production began, but then they rescinded. So what happened there, John?
Well, SAG believed that the production had not signed off on the proper paperwork, that they needed to have an agreement that they were going to follow safety protocols. Now, the production said it was kind of just a miscommunication error, but SAG is trying, you know, really carefully to make sure that its members are working in a safe environment. They don't want people going off on some show where it's going to be dangerous to their members, so they want to monitor what kind of rules are in place. And Adam Goodman talked a little bit about what was in place, because he does really want to make sure that this is a model that can be replicated going forward.
The actors were tested more frequently than almost anyone on the crew. All of our lighting, all of our setup was done prior to the actors arriving at camera in the morning. And so when they came to set, it was really them and the director and an AC and a AD and just a handful of critical shooting unit crew members.
So, John, how did shooting around LA go? How was that different from normal times?
Well, I'm sure you know when movie crews roll up into your neighborhood, you welcome them with open arms. I mean, one of the odd things about
just,
this town.
I always ask them, John, just give me a little space to get in my driveway, just a little bit. That's all I want.
One of the problems with shooting in LA is there's so many people, a lot of whom work in the business, who are like not in my backyard, and that's always been the case. Now you have, you know, a production, even though it's not a big production, you have scores of people coming in neighborhoods. And some residents, in fact, somebody emailed KPCC and said, I don't want him coming here. And he worked in the business. So Adam Goodman said there was a lot of concern and that they worked really hard to make sure that the neighbors knew what kind of safety protocols they were following and made sure that everybody felt comfortable.
I think once the community leaders and once neighborhood associations understood the level of testing and the level of protocol that the unit was under, people were very, you know, very welcoming, and the movie went on and off without a hitch. But in the beginning, it was daunting. Obviously, seeing what is essentially a circus pull into town and not know who these people are is a bit daunting. But that all worked its way through, and we shot in great neighborhoods all throughout the city.
So what's the takeaway from this story of making Songbird that maybe Hollywood could learn from?
Well, I think there are a couple takeaways. One is if you have safety protocols in place, actors will feel safe coming back to work. And the other is so many people in this town, crew, actors, you know, prop departments, you name it, they have not been working for 5 months now, and they're really eager to get back to work. So when there's a production that feels safe, they're really eager because they haven't had a chance. So this is what Adam Goodman said about kind of that esprit de corps that he sensed among the cast and crew on the set of Songbird.
The guilds and the unions and our crew members, everyone was trying to find a safe way back to working. And I don't know that I felt that level of camaraderie and that level of kinship in this city, maybe ever. It really just felt like there was more of a cause to make this movie than the film. And the film's pure popcorn, not to say that this movie is mission-based, but it did feel like the making of the movie was as important as the film itself.
You know what, John? It sounds like an injured athlete. Typically, athletes that are injured stay away from the team. They're not really around, and they just are dying to get back in there, to kind of just be around the teammates. So, John, will we now see more productions get back to work? And did Songbird basically just bust down that door?
I think a little bit. I mean, I think it's a door that is not going to get busted down. It's going to get chipped away at, you know, and sooner or later, we're going to see more productions coming back. But there's so many obstacles now. And imagine a story that doesn't require the characters to wear masks. You're making a modern day romantic comedy. So how are you going to cast actors who will play opposite one another? They can't wear masks because that doesn't work. So there's so many different parameters that are in place on other productions that weren't an issue with Songbird that I think are going to be a stumbling block. And it's also going to be, you know, who is willing to invest in this movie? This is an independent production. Is a big studio going to want to spend, you know, tens, if not hundreds of millions of dollars on a movie where they might have to shut it down if there's an outbreak? I think it's going to be a very slow process. I think Songbird is an interesting test case. And the other question is, we don't know how this film is going to be released. It was bought by STX, which is a theatrical distributor. But the way things are going, it could come out on some video on demand or digital platform. We don't even know how movies are going to be released toward the end of the year. So I think that's still a big question mark. And if you can't get a theater, it really does kind of limit the amount of money you want to invest in a production.
All right, one more thing. Your new episode of Hollywood the Sequel is out today. So who are your guests this week and what'd you talk about?
We talked with actress Glenn Close and Oscar-winning costume designer Ruth Carter. She did Black Panther. Both have very interesting takes on the business. Glenn Close is eager to get back to work, but she feels that she can't really go back until there's a vaccine. So we might not see Glenn Close in front of a camera for a very long time. And Ruth Carter won an Oscar for Black Panther. She's an African-American costume designer, and she talks about how difficult it is for Black filmmakers to get jobs and how she really is a trailblazer and hopes that her success can open the door for the next generation of people from underrepresented groups to become Oscar winners.
John Horn is the host of the LAS Studios podcast, Hollywood the Sequel. Latest episode is out right now. You can get it on Apple Podcasts or wherever you like to listen. John, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
And while you're looking for John Horn's Hollywood the Sequel podcast, why don't you find us, your buddies, here at Take Two. We're there as well, waiting to be heard by you. We're also all over social media. We're on Twitter, at Take Two. That's at Take Two. I'm there as well, at A Martinez LA. That's at A Martinez LA. Thanks for listening. Thanks for trusting us with your time. Take Two, back tomorrow at 2. Talk to you then.